Before we get into it, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. So if you're gearing up for the Series 63, they've got a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com. All right, let's jump in.
We'll do it.
So in 2023, a group of the most prestigious Wall Street firms got hit with fines totaling hundreds of millions of dollars. And, you know, regulators didn't levy these massive penalties because the firms were stealing client money.
No theft.
Yeah, they weren't front-running trades. They weren't running Ponzi schemes. They were fined simply because their employees were using WhatsApp on their personal phones to text about work.
Which sounds crazy, but that staggering financial penalty came down to one single fundamental regulatory concept. Basically, if you cannot monitor the conversation, you cannot supervise the employee.
Wow, yeah.
And if you cannot supervise the employee, well, you are failing your primary regulatory duty.
Right. So welcome to the world of broker-dealer supervision. If you are listening to this right now, yes, you the listener, you are on a highly specific mission. We are tackling the second half of the Series 63's broker-dealer regulation coverage.
The fun stuff.
Exactly, the intertwined worlds of exemptions and supervision. And the stakes for this material are, they're incredibly high for you as a test taker.
12%. That is the chunk of your exam score hanging on the concepts we're discussing today. So that translates to roughly 7 questions on the regulation of broker-dealers chapter.
7 questions, okay.
Yeah, and missing those 7 questions could very easily be the mechanical difference between, a passing grade and a failing one.
That's huge. But beyond just beating the exam, we really need to talk about why these rules exist in the real world. Because, in previous study units, you looked at the front door of the regulatory house.
Right, the entry point.
Yeah, you looked at who qualifies as a broker dealer, how a firm actually gets its license, and the exclusions, like the famous no place of business exclusion, right? Which determines who gets to stay outside the regulatory perimeter entirely.
Exactly. The material prior to this was all about the mechanics of entering the industry. But today, we are firmly inside the building.
The door is locked behind us.
Yep. This is post-registration reality. Once a firm has that license, what must they do to keep it? How do they manage record keeping? How do they handle financial reporting? And most critically, how does the firm watch its own people?
Because that brings us to supervision, which is arguably the core heartbeat of a broker-dealer's existence. I actually want to pause right here and ask you, yes, you listening, a direct question to test your instincts on this.
Love a good pop quiz.
Right. So think about it. Think about a massive financial firm with 10,000 employees. If one rogue agent sitting in a cubicle somewhere decides to just go off the rails, ignores the rule book, and commits blatant securities fraud against a client who gets in trouble, is it just that rogue agent? Give it a beat.
Take a second.
Nope. The firm is absolutely on the hook alongside them. A broker-dealer that fails to watch its agents can face catastrophic regulatory action, even if the executives at the top of the firm never, explicitly authorized a single bad trade.
And the philosophical shift in regulatory law here is just, it's fascinating. You have to stop thinking of a broker-dealer as merely a corporate umbrella for independent traders.
Right. They're not just renting desk space.
No, exactly. The Securities and Exchange Commission and state administrators, they do not have the manpower to personally watch every single registered representative in the country. There are simply too many trades, too many emails, and too many client meetings.
So they outsource the police work.
Exactly. They deputize the private firms. The regulators effectively tell the broker-dealers, hey, we grant you the license to make millions of dollars in this industry, but in exchange, you are required to act as our frontline enforcement mechanism.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. If your agents commit fraud, we aren't just going to punish them. We are going to punish you for failing to cash them.
Yeah.
So the firm becomes a living, breathing compliance organism.
So the rules we are looking at today constitute the immune system of that organism. If a virus, basically a rogue agent, gets in, the immune system has to isolate and neutralize it. If the immune system fails, the whole corporate body gets infected and the regulators step in to shut it down.
That is a perfect analogy. And that brings us to the foundational requirement. Every single broker dealer must establish, maintain, and enforce a supervisory system.
But there's a catch, right?
There is. The legal standard applied to this system is a phrase you need to burn into your memory for the exam. The system must be, quote, reasonably designed.
Reasonably designed to achieve compliance with securities laws, regulations, and FINRA rules. let's look at the mechanics of those two words, because I think a lot of people might picture a compliance system as a giant shark cage.
A shark cage.
Yeah. Like, if you are diving in dangerous waters with rogue agents, you build a steel cage. It has to be reasonably designed to keep the sharks out. But I actually think a better analogy for the modern era is software source code.
A digital firewall. Essentially.
Exactly. Well, wait, let me explain the mechanic of the firewall. If a firm builds a digital firewall, it has to be reasonably designed to block hackers. That means, you know, it needs up-to-date logic, it needs to scan incoming data, and it needs to lock out unauthorized users.
Makes sense.
If you build a firewall out of outdated code with massive, obvious backdoors, the regulators will say that system was not reasonably designed. Or if you build a shark cage out of wet spaghetti, not reasonably designed. But what if a microscopic zero-day exploit, something literally no one in the world has ever seen before, sneaks through a perfectly updated state-of-the-art firewall, or a microscopic shark slips through the bars?
Well, the firm wouldn't necessarily be held liable for a systemic failure in that specific zero-day scenario, because reasonably designed does not demand omniscient perfection.
Perfection is not required.
Right. The regulators know that human beings are endlessly creative when it comes to committing fraud. If a broker-dealer builds a sensible, robust compliance architecture and actually actively manages it, the mere fact that an isolated violation occurred does not automatically render the system legally flawed.
Okay, this sounds like a classic exam trap waiting to happen. Pattern interrupt, listener, pay attention to this.
Oh, is one of the most common traps on the Series 63. The question will describe a scenario where an agent commits a highly sophisticated, hidden violation. The trade slips through the cracks. Then the prompt will ask you to conclude whether the supervisory system failed or if the firm is guilty of a structural breakdown.
So if I'm taking the test and I see a single isolated violation, I shouldn't take the bait and assume the whole firewall is broken.
Exactly. The exam wants to see if you understand the difference between strict liability and reasonable supervision. A single missed violation does not prove the system was deficient.
Because that would be strict liability.
Exactly.
Right.
The test looks at the architecture of the system itself. Did they have meaningful procedures? Did they conduct regular audits? Did they investigate red flags? They did all those things, and the agent still managed to hide the fraud. The system itself was still reasonably designed.
Okay, so they don't expect the firm to have a magical crystal ball. They just expect them not to leave the vault door wide open. So let's talk about the architecture of this firewall. What are the actual lines of code? The sources outline a minimum viable system. What must a firm build to meet this reasonably designed standard?
Well, the baseline rule is comprehensive coverage. The system must cover every single associated person, meaning every agent, every assistant, every executive, and it must cover every single type of business the firm conducts.
So a firm couldn't say, hey, we heavily supervise our stock trading desks, but our investment banking division makes so much money, we just let them govern themselves.
Yeah, that would be a catastrophic failure.
Yeah.
Every division, no matter how profitable or autonomous they claim to be, falls under the compliance umbrella. To achieve this, the regulators mandate 5 specific pillars that every supervisory system must contain.
Let's lay out those 5 pillars.
First, the firm must establish written supervisory procedures, universally known as WSPs.
WSPs, got it.
Second, they must designate a registered principal with authority to supervise each specific type of business. Third, every location must be registered and designated as an office of supervisory jurisdiction, an OSJ, or a branch office, depending on the activities taking place there.
Okay, that's the rule book, the managers, and the real estate. What are the final two?
Fourth, every single registered person must be assigned to a qualified supervisor. No one operates in a vacuum. And fifth, the firm must mandate an annual compliance meeting or interview for every single registered representative and principal.
We are going to deconstruct the mechanics of every single one of those 5 pillars. But before we build this massive machine, I want to clarify the ultimate chain of command.
Okay, chain of command.
Yeah, because if a firm builds the WSPs, assigns the principals, registers the branches, and does the annual meetings, but an agent still commits massive fraud because a mid-level manager just fell asleep at the wheel, who is ultimately holding the bag.
The broker-dealer itself. The member firm retains final responsibility for proper supervision. The regulations are explicitly designed so that a corporate entity cannot simply point the finger at a middle manager and claim corporate innocence.
So the CEO can't say, hey, we hired a compliance officer, it's their fault, the firm should keep its license.
Nope. The individual supervisors face their own severe penalties, sure, but they do not absorb the overarching liability away from the broker-dealer. The buck stops at the very top of the corporate structure.
Okay, to help us navigate the chaotic reality of applying these rules, I think we need some test subjects. Yeah, I want to introduce a cast of characters that we are going to use to stress test this regulatory framework. Listener, I want you to picture these three people vividly because they represent the exact archetypes Finan and Ra and the state administrators built these rules to manage.
Let's meet the suspects.
First, we have Frantic Frank. Frank is an agent. He consumes like 6 shots of espresso before 9 a.m.
Naturally.
He talks incredibly fast. He views rules as, you know, mere suggestions. And he is singularly obsessed with generating the next massive commission check. Frank is the reason the compliance industry exists.
Oh, every firm on Wall Street has dealt with a Frantic Frank. They are high producers, which makes firms reluctant to fire them, but they are walking regulatory time bombs.
Exactly. Then we have Diligent Diane. Diane is a registered principal. She is Frank's boss. Diane has stress-induced migraines, color-coded WSP binders for every day of the week, and a terrifyingly deep understanding of her own personal liability. Her entire life is dedicated to keeping the firm from getting shut down.
The unsung hero of the financial sector. We love Diane.
We do. And finally, we have Clueless Carl. Carl is technically an associated person, but he operates entirely out of a tiny home office in his pajamas. He analyzes spreadsheets, rarely speaks to humans, and basically assumes that because he's small time, the rules don't really apply to him.
A very dangerous assumption in this industry.
Right. So we have Frantic Frank pushing the boundaries, Diligent Diane trying to hold the line, and Clueless Carl completely ignoring the line. Let's take our cast and look at the first pillar of the supervisory system you mentioned, the written supervisory procedures, the WSPs. You noted that a system is required, but a system is just an abstract philosophy without a rule book. The WSPs are the physical, actionable rule book.
The WSPs are the mechanical engine of compliance. Regulators are incredibly strict about how these procedures are drafted. Like, a firm cannot rely on vague corporate platitudes. A manual that says, all employees must act ethically and managers will keep an eye on things is legally worthless.
Right, because it doesn't give anyone a specific task. If I'm Diane and the book just says keep an eye on things, I don't know what I'm actually supposed to look at or when.
Exactly. The state administrator demands precision. For every single supervisory review that the firm conducts, the WSPs must explicitly identify 4 operational components. They must dictate the who, the what, the when, and the how.
Who, what, when, how. Okay, let's break down the mechanics of the who, what, when, and how using Frantic Frank. Let's say Frank is trading volatile penny stocks and the firm knows he's high risk. A terrible WSP would just say, Diane reviews Frank's trading. How do we upgrade that to a reasonably designed WSP?
Well, we start with the who. The procedure must identify the specific individual responsible for the review. In this case, it explicitly names Diligent Diane, the registered principal.
Not just a manager, it has to be Diane.
Exactly. Then we define the what. The document must outline the exact supervisory activities she will perform. Instead of reviewing trading, the WSP states she will review Frank's daily trade blotter and his incoming client emails.
Okay, just to clarify the mechanics for the listener, a trade blotter is basically a raw chronological ledger of every single transaction Frank executed that day, right?
Yeah, it is the raw data feed. It shows what he bought, what he sold, the time, the price, and the client account. It's the purest view of his activity.
Okay, so Diane is the who, the trade blotter is the what. Now for the when.
The frequency of the review must be scheduled. So the WSP might mandate that Diane reviews the blotter every single Friday by 5:00 p.m.
And finally, the how, which seems like the most critical piece for an audit, because if Diane reads the blotter on Friday at 4:59 p.m. but doesn't leave a trace, the regulator 3 years later will just assume she was at happy hour.
Right. The how dictates the manner of documentation. The WSP must require Diane to physically sign and date the printed blotter or, you know, apply a secure cryptographic digital signature in the compliance software and then archive it in a specific folder.
Okay, so who, what, when, how, Diane, the blotter, Friday at 5 p.m., physical signature.
Yep. That is a procedure you can audit. When Finan walks in, they don't have to guess. They just ask Diane to produce the folder with the Friday signatures. If there are missing weeks, the firm has a failure to supervise.
The regulators actually provide a mandatory checklist of specific areas that these WSPs absolutely must cover, right? Like, a firm can't just pick and choose what they want to supervise.
No, definitely not. There are mandatory areas.
Let's run through that list. What are the non-negotiable areas that must have a who, what, when, and how?
The first area is investment banking and securities business. For these activities, the WSPs must demand principal review of all transactions, and that review must be evidenced in writing.
The mechanics of investment banking make this obvious. We aren't talking about Frank buying 100 shares of Apple for a retiree. Investment banking involves, like, structuring initial public offerings, underwriting massive debt issuances, and handling millions or billions of dollars.
Right, it's huge scale.
If a rogue agent messes up an underwriting deal, they can crash the entire firm overnight. So a principal has to have their fingerprints on every single deal.
The risk profile is astronomical, hence the mandatory principal review. Now, the second mandatory area is correspondence and internal communications. The firm must have procedures detailing the review of incoming, outgoing, and internal written and electronic correspondence.
We are going to dedicate a massive chunk of this deep dive to communications later because the exam loves to test the mechanics of how Frank talks to clients. But I want to highlight the word internal there. The firm doesn't just watch what Frank says to the public. They watch what Frank says to his coworkers. What's the third area?
Customer complaints. The WSPs must include procedures to promptly capture, acknowledge, and respond to every single written or electronic complaint.
And the operative word there is promptly. If Frank loses a client's life savings and the client sends a furious email to the firm's general inbox, the WSP cannot allow that email to sit unread for 3 weeks while the administrative assistant is on vacation.
No, the procedure must ensure immediate triage. A delayed response to a complaint is treated as a massive red flag by regulators. It suggests the firm is either incompetent or actively trying to bury the issue.
Okay, what's the final one?
The final specific area mandated in the sources involves the firm's own organizational chart. The broker-dealer must maintain a precise record of all designated supervisory personnel.
So they need a historical ledger of who the bosses were at any given time.
Exactly. They have to record the names, the dates they assumed their roles, and the specific responsibilities they held. Because if a fraud occurred in 2024, the regulators need to know exactly who was in Diane's seat in 2024. And there is a specific timeline attached to this record. It must be kept for at least 3 years, and for the first 2 years, it must be kept in an easily accessible location.
Listener, write that down. 3 years total, 2 years easily accessible. That timeline applies to so many different records on the Series 63. It's one of your most valuable pieces of memorized data.
It really is. And it is vital to remember that a firm's WSPs are not static documents. You don't write them once in 2010 and leave them in a drawer. The rules explicitly state they must be updated promptly to reflect changes in the firm's business lines or changes in regulatory requirements.
Okay, so if Frantic Frank convinces the firm to let him start trading highly complex cryptocurrency derivatives, the old rule book that only covers basic stocks is suddenly obsolete. Diane has to write a brand new chapter outlining the who, what, when, and how for crypto before Frank executes his first trade.
If she doesn't, the firm is conducting unsupervised business. Furthermore, a physical or electronic copy of these procedures must be kept at every single OSJ and at each location where supervisory activities occur.
Okay, wait. I want to inject a scenario here because a massive logical loophole just occurred to me based on this structure.
Sure, let's hear it.
We've established that diligent Diane is the registered principal. She's the one writing the rule book. She is the one reviewing the blotters. She is the boss. But Diane is also registered to trade herself. She has her own clients. Can Diane supervise her own trading activity? Like, can she review her own emails and approve her own performance bonuses?
Oh, that's a great question. The structural conflict of interest you're pointing out is a major focus for examiners.
Yeah.
The foundational rule is a hard prohibition. A supervisor generally cannot supervise their own activities.
Because if she could, the entire system is just the honor system.
Right. And the logic goes even further. Not only can a supervisor not review their own trades, but they also cannot report to or have their compensation determined by a person that they are supervising.
Oh, wow. So if Frantic Frank is generating massive commissions and he somehow gets promoted to be Diane's compensation manager, but Diane is still his compliance supervisor, the dynamic is completely poisoned.
The leverage Frank would have is obvious. He could imply, you know, Diane, if you look the other way on these questionable penny stock trades I'm doing, I will make sure your year-end bonus doubles. The regulatory framework demands absolute independence and supervision to sever that exact leverage.
But wait, let's pressure test this rule. Wall Street has massive banks, sure, but it also has thousands of tiny independent broker-dealers. What if Frank and Diane decide they are tired of corporate life, So they quit and start their own boutique firm. It's literally just the two of them in a rented office. If Diane can't supervise herself, and she can't have Frank supervise her because she sets his pay, how does a two-person firm legally exist?
Ah, the regulators had to create an exception to avoid accidentally outlawing small businesses. If a member firm is so small that avoiding this conflict of interest is mechanically impossible, the prohibition is waived. However, the regulatory burden shifts heavily.
How so? They don't just get a free pass.
Far from it. The firm must rigorously document the specific reasons why the conflict is unavoidable. They can't just say, oh, we are small. They have to prove that hiring a third party or an independent principal is economically or structurally unfeasible. Furthermore, they must document exactly how they're adjusting their alternative supervisory procedures to mitigate the massive risk they're taking on by allowing self-supervision.
So if I'm taking the exam and I see a question about self-supervision, the baseline answer is NO, it's banned. But if the question specifies a tiny firm with no other personnel options, the answer flips to yes, but only with a mountain of justifying paperwork.
Exactly. The exam tests your ability to recognize the general rule versus the structural exception. Now, let's tie this back to the second pillar of the supervisory system we mentioned earlier, assigning a registered principal to each type of business. The key mechanism here is the word appropriately.
We briefly touched on this, but let's dig into the mechanics. Broker-dealers must designate appropriately registered principals with the authority to supervise each specific business line. What does appropriately registered actually mean in practice?
It means the principal's licensing must match the specific risk profile of the product they are supervising. The securities industry is vast. A principal who spent 20 years supervising municipal bonds knows everything about tax yields and local government debt. But if you suddenly ask that same principal to supervise frantic Frank while he trades highly leveraged foreign currency options, that principal is effectively blind.
Right. They wouldn't even know what red flags to look for in the trade blotter.
The mechanics of the products are totally different. Therefore, the rules mandate that the principal must have passed the specific examinations and hold the specific registrations relevant to the desk they manage. If Frank trades options, Diane must be a registered options principal.
And building on that chain of command, the WSPs have to outline exactly where all these principals and agents physically sit. Which brings us to the third pillar, the real estate. In the eyes of FANRA and state regulators, the actual physical location of a desk changes the regulatory burden entirely.
Because the physical location dictates the concentration of risk, and the concentration of risk dictates the frequency and intensity of required supervision.
Okay, listener, this is where you need to visualize a hierarchy. We are going to construct a side-by-side comparison of the three regulatory tiers of office locations. Tier 1 is the OSJ. Tier 2 is the branch office. Tier 3 is the non-branch location. Let's start at the absolute top of the pyramid. Tier 1, the Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction. I like to call this location the mothership. What specific activities automatically turn a regular office into a mothership?
The designation of an OSJ is entirely driven by the mechanical functions performed inside its walls. The regulators provide a definitive list of triggers. If any single one of these activities occurs, the location is elevated to an OSJ.
Let's analyze the mechanics of these triggers. What's the first one?
Order execution or market making.
Okay, let's pause and explain why that is a trigger. Market making isn't just Frank buying a stock for a client. Market making means the firm is using its own corporate capital to hold massive amounts of a specific stock, constantly quoting buy and sell prices to provide liquidity to the open market.
Right, the financial exposure is enormous. A bad market maker can bankrupt a firm in an afternoon or severely manipulate the price of a public security. Because the systemic risk is so high, the office handling those trades must be under the tightest possible supervision.
Okay, what's the second trigger?
The second trigger is structuring public offerings or private placements.
Again, this is investment banking. It's raising millions of dollars for corporations. The legal liability if the offering documents contain a lie is massive. What's the third trigger?
Maintaining custody of customer funds or securities.
Custody. This is arguably the biggest one. Listener, think about this logically. If Frank only gives advice, the worst thing he can do is give bad advice. But if Frank's office physically receives the client's checkbook or holds the digital keys to their assets, he has the mechanical ability to steal the money directly.
Exactly. Custody is the gateway to embezzlement. The moment an office takes physical possession of client funds, the regulatory alarms go off.
What are the other OSJ triggers?
Giving final approval to new customer accounts, reviewing and endorsing customer orders, giving final approval to retail communications, and finally, assuming the responsibility for supervising associated persons at other branch offices.
Let's look at those final approval triggers. Approving new accounts, orders, and communications. Why does the final sign-off trigger OSJ status?
Well, the final approval is the firm's legal seal. When Diane signs off on a new account, she is verifying that the firm has completed its anti-money laundering checks and know your customer protocols. She is confirming this isn't a terrorist financing account. When she approves a retail communication, like a TV commercial or a mass email, she is confirming it doesn't contain illegal promises of guaranteed returns. The location where that final rubber stamp hits the paper is the nerve center of compliance.
It's where the buck stops. So, because the mothership is handling market making, custody, and final approvals, what are the staffing requirements? Can Diane manage the OSJ remotely from her beach house?
Absolutely not. The regulatory burden for an OSJ demands a registered principal with a regular physical on-site presence. The captain must be on the deck of the mothership. They cannot phone it in.
Now, I want to flag a very specific exception in the sources before we move to Tier 2. It mentions a narrow carve-out for research reports.
Yes, and the exam writers love this distractor.
Yeah.
We just established that final approval of retail communications makes an office an OSJ. However, if an office does absolutely nothing else on the trigger list, no custody, no new accounts, no market making, but its sole supervisory function is giving final approval to research reports, it does not automatically become an OSJ.
So if a firm has a secluded office full of analysts who just finalize reports on tech stocks, that office doesn't need a massive OSJ compliance apparatus just for that one function. Good to know. Let's step down the pyramid to Tier 2, the branch office. If the OSJ is the mothership, the branch office is the scouting ship. What is the mechanical definition of a branch?
The legal definition is broad. A branch office is any location where one or more associated persons regularly conduct the business of effecting any transactions in, or inducing or attempting to induce the purchase or sale of any security.
Let's dissect the phrase attempting to induce. If Frantic Frank rents a beautiful office overlooking the city, and all he does all day is drink espresso, call wealthy clients, and pitch them hot stock tips, he isn't actually executing the trades there. He sends the trade tickets to the mothership for execution. But because he is verbally trying to convince people to buy, he is attempting to induce a sale.
Right. The act of pitching the client triggers the branch office designation.
Does a branch office require a registered principal on site like the OSJ does?
It does not have the same severe requirement. A branch requires a designated supervisor, but that supervisor does not necessarily have to hold a principal registration, and the physical presence requirements are slightly more flexible, though they still require diligent oversight based on the WSPs.
Okay, so that is Tier 1 and Tier 2. Now we descend to the absolute bottom of the pyramid, Tier 3, the non-branch location. This is clueless Carl territory.
Carl operating from his couch in his pajamas. The structural definition of a non-branch location is simply a location that fails to meet the definition of a branch office.
Which means Carl is not regularly attempting to induce sales to the public from his living room. The classic exam example is the back office admin or the analyst running spreadsheets who never meets a client in person and never handles a single dollar of client money.
Their regulatory footprint is incredibly light. Because they pose vastly less risk to the public, the location is overseen simply through the firm's standard written supervisory procedures without the heavy requirements of a registered branch.
Okay, listener, it is time for a direct question. I want you to synthesize these definitions. Here's the scenario. Frantic Frank has a massive, luxurious downtown office. He has mahogany desks. He meets high net worth clients there every single day. He spends 10 hours a day aggressively pitching them stocks, attempting to induce sales. However, he's strictly forbidden from holding their money, no custody, and he cannot give final approval to open their accounts. He has to courier those applications to Diane at the mothership. So, based on the mechanics, is Frank's downtown office an OSJ or a branch office? Take a beat and apply the rules.
Think about the triggers.
It is a branch office.
Exactly. This scenario is engineered to trick your intuition. The exam will paint a picture of a bustling, vital, expensive-sounding location. They want you to conflate busy with OSJ. But you must relentlessly scan the scenario for the mechanical triggers. Did Frank have custody? No. Did he have final approval power? No. Did he make markets? No.
He just met clients and pitched them. That is the literal definition of inducing a sale, which makes it a branch.
The distinction between an OSJ and a branch on the exam almost always hinges on custody or final approval. If you do not see those words, hesitate before assuming it's an OSJ.
But let's say Frank's client brings a physical check to the downtown office made out to the broker-dealer, and Frank accepts it and puts it in his top desk drawer to send to Diane the next morning. What just happened?
Oh, by taking physical possession of that check overnight, Frank just engaged in maintaining custody of customer funds. He instantly triggered OSJ status for that location, and because that location isn't registered as an OSJ and doesn't have an on-site principal, he and the firm just committed a severe regulatory violation.
Wow. The mechanics are ruthless. Okay, so we have mapped the real estate. We know what the mothership, the scouting ship, and the couch look like. But a system isn't just about identifying offices. It's about auditing them. How often does diligent Diane have to physically inspect these locations?
The physical real estate tier dictates the inspection timeline. The higher the risk, the shorter the leash.
Let's start back at the top. Tier 1, the OSJ. Because the mothership is holding the money, approving the accounts, and making the markets the risk, is at maximum capacity. How often does Diane audit the OSJ?
An office of supervisory jurisdiction must be inspected at least annually, and the regulation specifies this must be done on a calendar year basis.
Every single calendar year, the firewall gets stress tested. What about Tier 2, the standard branch office where Frank pitches clients?
Standard branch offices must be inspected at least every 3 years. However, this is not an automatic, lazy 3-year cycle. The firm is required to establish an inspection cycle based on a documented risk assessment.
Explain the mechanics of that risk assessment.
Diane has to evaluate the specific branch. She looks at the volume of trading. She looks at the complexity of the products Frank is selling. She looks at his disciplinary history. If Frank's branch is exploding with high-risk options trades and a history of customer complaints, Diane's risk assessment might dictate that she inspects his branch every 18 months. But under no circumstances can the gap exceed 3 years.
3 years is the absolute ceiling. What about Tier 3, Carl on his couch?
Non-branch locations must be inspected on a regular periodic schedule that the firm defines. While the statute doesn't explicitly mandate a hard deadline, there is a strong regulatory presumption that it should occur at least every 3 years.
Okay, so the baseline memorization is OSJ is 1 year, branch is maximum 3 years, non-branch is presumed 3 years. That seems straightforward. But wait, if I think about the triggers we discussed earlier, I think there is a cascading logic trap hidden here.
Oh, the rules regarding cascading supervision create one of the most punishing traps on the exam. Let's build the narrative to see how it works.
Let's say Frantic Frank is tired of just being an agent. He wants management experience, so he goes to Diane and says, hey, let me be the designated supervisor for Clueless Carl's home office. I'll review his spreadsheets. Diane, desperate for less work, agrees. Frank's office is still just a standard Tier 2 branch, no custody, no final approvals. But now, Frank's branch is supervising Carl's non-branch location. What happens to Frank's inspection timeline?
It immediately upgrades to the highest level. If a non-OSJ branch office is assigned to supervise one or more non-branch locations, it legally takes on the OSJ inspection schedule. Frank's branch must now be inspected annually.
Let's break down the underlying mechanism there because it makes perfect sense if you connect the dots. One of the triggers for an OSJ is assuming the responsibility for supervising associated persons at other branch offices. While Carl's couch isn't technically a branch, Frank's office has assumed a centralized, authoritative, supervisory role over another physical location.
The regulators view the assumption of authority as an assumption of risk. If Frank is now acting as a boss, the regulators demand that Diane check on the boss every single year.
The exam will absolutely try to bury this detail. They will describe a regular branch office, ask for the inspection timeline, and hope you reflexively click 3 years. If you miss the single sentence mentioning that the branch supervises a remote employee, you fail the question.
You know, when Diane actually performs these inspections, whether annual or triennial, she cannot simply walk through the office, chat by the water cooler, and leave.
Right, the WSPs dictate the how.
Exactly. The inspections must be reasonably designed to detect and prevent violations. More importantly, the results of every single inspection must be documented in a written report.
And that report doesn't just disappear.
It becomes part of the firm's permanent compliance record. If the regulators audit the firm, they will demand to see the last 3 years of branch inspection reports. If Diane didn't document it, in the eyes of the law, the inspection never happened.
So the real estate is handled. We inspect the high-risk offices annually and the lower-risk ones every 3 years. But let's be realistic about human behavior. A lot of fraud can happen in a 3-year window. Hell, Frantic Frank can do a lot of damage in 3 weeks. How does a firm monitor the pulse of its agents between these physical inspections?
They monitor the paper trail. The rules surrounding communications and complaints are the day-to-day surveillance grid of the supervisory system.
What are the mechanics of this surveillance? Does Diane literally have to read every single word Frank types on his keyboard?
She doesn't have to read his grocery list, but the mandate for business-related communication is vast. Firms must establish written procedures for the review of incoming and outgoing correspondence with the public that relates to their investment banking or securities business.
Incoming and outgoing public correspondence. That makes sense. Pitch decks, client letters, responses to complaints. But the sources don't stop there.
No, the most critical part of this rule is that firms must also review internal communications between associated persons.
If we take that a step further, why do regulators care what Frank and Carl say to each other internally? The public isn't seeing it.
The underlying mechanism of massive financial fraud almost always relies on internal collusion. Think about market manipulation, or front-running a massive client order, or hiding a catastrophic trading error in a suspense account. Frank isn't going to email a retail client and say, hey, I'm hiding losses. He is going to message Carl and say, can you bury these trades on the back end spreadsheet until next quarter?
Wow, the call is coming from inside the house. Reviewing internal communications is how the immune system catches the virus before it ever breaches the skin and harms the public.
Internal review is essential for preemptive compliance.
Okay, let's talk about the format of these communications, because this brings us full circle to the $200 million fines we talked about at the very beginning of the deep dive. The modern agent does not rely on watermarked stationery. Frantic Frank is moving fast. He shoots off quick emails. He texts clients from his iPhone. He might even slide into a client's Instagram direct messages to pitch a trendy new tech stock. How do the rules handle different mediums?
The law is format agnostic. The medium is entirely irrelevant. Electronic communications, whether they are emails, SMS text messages, instant messages, or social media direct messages, are subject to the exact same supervisory review requirements as traditional paper correspondence.
If the message relates to the broker-dealer's business, it is a business record, full stop.
And this creates a monumental logistical nightmare for the firm, which brings us to the WhatsApp fines. If Frantic Frank conducts business on an encrypted app on his personal phone, Diligent Diane cannot physically review those messages.
Because she doesn't have his passcode and the firm's software isn't linked to it?
If she cannot review the messages, the firm cannot fulfill its supervisory duty. The firm is effectively operating blind. The massive fines levied on Wall Street were because the regulators discovered systemic, widespread use of unapproved, unmonitored communication channels. The firms had failed to maintain their surveillance grid.
So the WSPs must explicitly forbid the use of any communication channel that the firm cannot archive and review. Now, logistically, let's look at the sheer volume of this data. Frank alone might send 500 emails a day. A firm might have 1,000 Franks. There is no mathematical way Diane, as a registered principal, can read 500,000 emails a day.
The framework addresses this bottleneck through the mechanics of delegation. The rules require that the review of correspondence be performed by a registered principal. However, a principal may delegate specific review tasks to an unregistered person.
Let's map out how that actually works.
Diane might implement an automated software system that scans all emails for high-risk keywords, words like guarantee, promise, or furious. Then she might delegate an unregistered administrative assistant, let's call him an intern, to do a manual first pass of the flagged emails to filter out the false positives.
So the intern reads the boring stuff and only hands the genuinely terrifying emails up to Diane.
The delegation of the physical task is perfectly legal and necessary for efficiency.
But I see a massive structural risk here. What if the intern is terrible at their job? What if Frank sends an email clearly stating, I am going to churn your account to generate massive commissions for myself, and the intern just clicks approve without reading it? When the regulators show up, can Diane just point at the intern and say, not my fault, I delegated the task to him?
The law firmly rejects that defense. This is the difference between delegating a task and delegating responsibility. The registered principal may delegate the labor, but they retain the ultimate liability for the supervisory function.
If the intern missed it, Diane missed it.
And if Diane missed it, the firm missed it. The chain of accountability always snaps back to the registered principal and the firm itself.
Which provides the perfect transition into the heaviest, most punitive section of this entire regulatory framework. The guillotine.
Supervisory liability.
We have spent an incredible amount of time constructing this architecture. We wrote the WSPs defining who, what, when, and how. We mapped the OSJs and branch offices. We scheduled the risk-assessed inspections. We built the communication surveillance grid. What happens when the architecture fundamentally fails? What happens if Diane is overwhelmed? She stops reading the flagged emails. She stops conducting the branch audits. And frantic Frank is left completely unsupervised to run a multi-million-dollar scam.
The consequences are existential. The state administrator possesses the authority to deploy a specific, devastating weapon against the broker-dealer, a charge of failure to reasonably supervise.
Let's look at the arsenal the administrator has if this charge sticks.
They can deny a firm's registration outright. They can suspend it, revoke it, bar individuals from the industry, issue a formal censure, or strictly limit the firm's business activities, for instance, banning them from trading options entirely.
Now, obviously, if Frank stole millions of dollars, Frank is going to jail or facing massive civil penalties. But why does the firm get its license revoked if Frank acted alone?
Because failure to reasonably supervise is an independent, standalone ground for disciplinary action.
Let's unpack the mechanics of a standalone ground, because this is the mind-bending part of the law.
It means the administrator does not have to prove that the broker-dealer itself, as a corporate entity, committed a direct securities violation, like executing a fraudulent trade. The firm didn't tell Frank to steal. But more shockingly, proof of an actual, completed underlying violation by the agent is not even strictly essential to sustain a failure to supervise charge.
Let's construct a scenario to test how crazy that actually is. Let's say frantic Frank formulates a master plan to churn his clients' accounts. He intends to buy and sell the same stocks 50 times a day just to generate thousands of dollars in commission fees for himself. But because Frank is chaotic, he enters the wrong account numbers, his internet goes down, and the trades never actually execute. No client loses a dime. The fraud was a complete failure. But while investigating Frank's botched attempt, the regulator discovers that Diane hadn't checked Frank's blotter in 6 months, and the WSP binder was being used as a doorstop. Are you saying the firm can get nuked even though Frank's fraud never materialized?
The firm can face severe sanctions. The failure of the broker-dealer to maintain and enforce its supervisory system is its own separate, punishable crime. The regulators are prosecuting the broken firewall, not just the virus. If the vault door was left wide open, the bank is guilty of gross negligence, regardless of whether a robber actually walked in that day.
That shifts the entire paradigm. Yeah. The firm is guilty of failing to manage the environment. However, giving a state administrator the power to revoke a firm's license over a systemic flaw seems incredibly dangerous. What if the regulator is just on a power trip? Can they drop the guillotine over a minor paperwork error?
The statute contains a vital failsafe to prevent draconian regulatory overreach. The Uniform Securities Act requires the administrator to satisfy a two-part test before they can sanction a firm for this.
What is the first element of the test?
The first element is factual. The administrator must find that the broker-dealer actually failed reasonably to supervise its agents or employees.
Firewall was actually broken. What is the second element?
The second element is philosophical. The administrator must find that the disciplinary order is in the public interest.
Let's explore why that second element is the linchpin of the whole system.
The public interest requirement exists to ensure the punishment is proportionate to the systemic risk. Imagine a scenario where diligent Diane has been perfectly executing her supervisory duties for 10 years. But 1 week, she gets the flu, and she forgets to physically sign one of Frank's daily trade blotters on a Friday afternoon.
Technically, she violated the WSP. She failed to supervise for that one day.
If the public interest requirement didn't exist, a vindictive regulator could technically point to that missing signature and revoke the firm's registration, putting thousands of innocent employees out of work over a single typo.
The public interest test forces the regulator to step back and ask, does destroying this company over a missed signature actually protect the investing public? And the answer is obviously no.
Exactly. The administrator must weigh the severity of the failure against the broader market impact. If the firm let Frank run a Ponzi scheme for a year, shutting them down protects the public. If it's a minor administrative lapse, a censure or a fine is appropriate, not a death sentence.
This brings a necessary standard of reasonableness to the regulators themselves. Now, let's explore the defensive posture of the firm. Let's say Frank is running a massive scam and it actually succeeds. The regulator comes knocking. Can the partners at the top of the firm deploy the ostrich defense? Can they stick their heads in the sand and argue, hey, we were busy playing golf. We never looked at Frank's file, so we had absolutely no knowledge of his fraud. You cannot punish us for something we didn't know about.
the ostrich defense is systematically dismantled by the legal framework. A broker-dealer cannot avoid liability by claiming ignorance of misconduct if reasonable supervision would have detected it.
If the firewall logs would have shown the virus, the fact that you never checked the logs is the exact reason you are guilty.
Ignorance in compliance is the definition of negligence. Furthermore, this liability travels straight up the corporate ladder. Supervisory liability extends to the broker-dealer's partners, officers, and directors if they had supervisory responsibility and failed to exercise it.
The executives can't hide behind the corporate veil. If they cultivated a culture where compliance was ignored, the executives can be personally barred from the securities industry for life.
The regulators want the fear of personal ruin to motivate executive oversight.
Okay, so the threat is existential, and ignorance is no excuse. If a rogue agent commits fraud, is the firm automatically doomed? Is it strict liability, or is there a way to survive the guillotine?
It is not strict liability. The firm is not automatically doomed just because a rogue agent succeeded. There is an ironclad defense, but it takes the form of a very strict three-pronged shield. To defend itself against a failure to supervise claim, the broker-dealer must prove all three elements of this shield. If even one prong is missing, the defense shatters.
Listener, this is where you lock in. The three-pronged shield is one of the most heavily tested concepts because it synthesizes everything we've talked about today. Let's forge the shield. What is prong number one?
Prong one. The firm must prove that it had written supervisory procedures in place.
We spent half the deep dive on this. You need the playbook. You cannot enforce rules that do not exist on paper. What is prong two?
Prong two. The firm must prove that those written procedures were reasonably enforced.
You actually played the game according to the playbook. And what is the final third prong?
Prong three. The firm must prove that the underlying violation occurred despite the firm's good faith efforts to supervise.
Good faith efforts. I want to relentlessly pressure test this shield with some rapid fire scenarios. Listener, I'm going to paint a picture, and I want you to evaluate whether the firm can successfully deploy the three-pronged shield to survive the regulatory guillotine.
Let's put the shield to the test.
Scenario A. The broker-dealer is incredibly wealthy. They hire the most expensive securities law firm in New York to draft a gold-plated, leather-bound WSP binder. It is a masterpiece of compliance architecture. But the firm puts the binder on a shelf in the break room where it collects dust for 4 years. Diane never reads it, and no one ever reviews Frank's trades. Frank inevitably commits massive fraud. Can the firm use the shield? Take a beat.
Let them think.
The answer is no.
This scenario is the textbook definition of failing prong two. The firm had the procedures. Prong one is satisfied, but paper compliance offers zero legal protection. If the procedures are not actively and reasonably enforced, the system is a facade.
Okay, scenario B. The firm has great WSPs, and Diane is usually on top of her game. She enforces the rules. One Tuesday, Diane is reviewing the daily blotter and notices that Frantic Frank has generated 10 times his usual commission volume overnight, entirely in highly illiquid penny stocks. It is a blindingly bright red flag. However, Diane is currently buried in paperwork preparing for an upcoming FINRA audit on a different issue. She decides she is too busy to investigate Frank's trades this week and plans to look at it next month. By next month, Frank's fraud is complete and the clients are ruined. Can the firm use the shield? Give it a beat.
Think about Diane's actions.
Let's know again.
This scenario violently shatters prong three, good faith efforts. The essence of good faith is how you react to anomalies. If your reasonably designed system successfully catches a massive warning sign, a red flag, and you choose to ignore it for convenience, your supervision instantly ceases to be reasonable. Ignoring a red flag completely destroys the defense.
Okay, the final test. Scenario C. The firm has meticulous WSPs. Diane enforces them with ruthless consistency. She reviews Frank's blotters every Friday. She utilizes software to scan all his corporate emails. She conducts the annual OSJ audit. Every metric she has access to looks completely normal. But unbeknownst to anyone, Frank is operating a shadow business. He has an encrypted burner phone taped to the inside of the ceiling tiles in the men's restroom. He meets clients in cash-only transactions in dark alleys off the grid. None of his fraud touches the firm's servers or bank accounts. Frank's fraud is eventually uncovered by the FBI. Can the firm use the shield against a failure to supervise charge? Take a beat.
Here's the final verdict.
Yes.
This is the perfect deployment of the three-pronged shield. In this scenario, the firm survives. They had the procedures, they enforced them vigorously, and they acted in absolute good faith based on the data available to them.
Because if we loop back to the very beginning, the system only has to be reasonably designed. The law does not expect diligent Diane to be an omniscient mind reader. It does not expect her to hire a SWAT team to dismantle the ceiling tiles looking for burner phones unless there was a specific red flag prompting that search.
Exactly. The standard is reasonable supervision, not perfect, impenetrable supervision. A broker-dealer is not strictly liable merely because a highly motivated criminal managed to bypass their security. The regulatory question is always, did the firm do what a prudent, reasonable organization would do to prevent and detect this behavior? If they did, they are shielded from the failure to supervise charge, even though Frank is going to federal prison.
That distinction is paramount for the exam. The test writers will try to emotionally trick you. They will describe a horrific fraud where grandmothers lose their life savings, and they want you to aggressively punish everyone involved, including the firm. You have to detach your emotions and evaluate the firm's architecture separately from Frank's outcome.
Master that analytical separation, and you will navigate the hardest scenario questions on the Series 63 with ease.
This has been an incredibly dense mechanical journey through the regulatory framework. We've built the source code of the WSPs, mapped the geographical risk of the offices, monitored the internal communications, and survived the guillotine with a three-pronged shield. Before we close this out, we need to consolidate this knowledge. We are going to do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute most critical, testable takeaways we've covered today.
Let's lock in the core concepts.
First, the real estate hierarchy. How do you spot an OSJ versus a branch office?
Look for the high-risk triggers. An OSJ executes orders, makes markets, gives final approvals for accounts and communications, and maintains custody of funds. A branch office is simply where associated persons attempt to induce sales from the public.
Next, the inspection schedule based on that real estate.
The mothership OSJ must be inspected at least annually. A standard branch office is inspected on a risk assess cycle, but at least every 3 years.
And the massive cascading risk trap regarding those inspections.
Oh, if a standard branch office is assigned supervisory responsibility over a non-branch location, it inherits the risk profile of an OSJ, and its inspection cycle upgrades to annually.
The mechanics of the written supervisory procedures, what must they explicitly detail?
They cannot be abstract. They must dictate who is responsible, what they are reviewing, when they review it, and how the review is documented.
The nature of the guillotine. What makes failure to supervise so dangerous?
It is a standalone, independent violation. The firm can be severely sanctioned for having a broken compliance system, even if the rogue agent's underlying fraud was never fully completed, provided the administrator finds the sanction is in the public interest.
Finally, the survival mechanism, the three-pronged shield.
To defeat a failure to supervise charge, the firm must prove three things simultaneously. They had written procedures in place, they actually enforced those procedures reasonably, and they made a good faith effort to supervise, meaning they did not ignore red flags.
That is the mechanical core of broker-dealer supervision. If you understand how those gears turn, you are ready for this section of the exam. But before we sign off, I want to pivot away from the exam and look at the reality of this industry.
Yeah, we spent a massive amount of time today dissecting how a firm monitors communications, the emails, the texts, the requirement to supervise internal messaging. But if you step back, there is a fundamental friction between regulatory law and human behavior.
Right.
The laws we are studying move at the speed of government bureaucracy. They take years to draft, debate, and implement. But communication technology moves at blinding speed. Think about the challenge firms face today in maintaining a reasonably designed system. How does a modern, diligent Diane write WSPs to supervise an agent who uses ephemeral messaging apps, where the data literally self-destructs after 10 seconds? How does a firm monitor communication when agents start using AI assistants that autonomously generate and send market commentary to clients while the agent sleeps?
That is wild to think about.
It really is. The regulatory gap is constantly widening. As you step into this industry, the challenge won't just be following the rules written in the past. It will be figuring out how to architect a compliance system that can adapt to the technology of the future, all while keeping that three-pronged shield intact. It is a terrifying, fascinating problem to solve.
It redefines what reasonable is going to mean for the next generation of finance. Thank you so much for taking this deep dive with us today. Keep studying the mechanics, remember the triggers, respect the three prongs, and go crush the Series 63. You've got this. Catch you next time.